report a single word of this mess. What if I want you to act like we never met and none of this ever happened?
That's not realistic.
Well, then we have a problem.
Looking at him, she wondered why he would have to be so secretive.
Who do you work for?
I can't tell you that.
Rapp shoved his pistol back in its holster.
Seriously, I'd like to know.
And seriously, Rapp shook his head and opened his eyes wide. I can't tell you.
It must be the CIA.
Reilly kept her eyes on him, trying to get the slightest hint of a reaction. She got nothing.
It has to be the CIA, otherwise you could tell me.
Wrong. Are you a woman of your word?
Yes.
Good. Then someday, if we both make it out of here alive, I'll tell you my life story.
Rapp smiled, showing a set of long dimples on both cheeks. Reilly smiled back and nodded.
So, you work for the CIA.
I never said that, replied Rapp.
Irene Kennedy stood over the secure phone in General Flood's office and felt a sinking feeling in the pit of her stomach. On the other end was Colonel Fine of the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service, Mossad. Fine had just given Kennedy a brief overview on the three names she had given him the night before. There was no surprising information on the first two terrorists, but the third was an entirely different matter. Mustafa Yassin was the man in question, and Kennedy was curious. The colonel had come up with three matches on the name Mustafa Yassin. The first was a 57-year-old officer in the Jordanian army, and the second was an 18-year-old suspected Palestinian dissident. When Colonel Fine finished giving the background on the individuals, Kennedy asked,
"Could you repeat the info on the last Yassin, please?"
"Sure, but let me caution you. Yassin is a fairly common name over here, so this might not be the same guy. The last Mustafa Yassin is an Iraqi. We don't have a lot of information on him, but what we do have all revolves around the invasion of Kuwait. Since then, there has only been one update added to his file. According to our intelligence, his alias is the Thief of Baghdad. When the Iraqis rolled into Kuwait and started looting, it was this Yassin fellow who they put in charge of breaking into all of the bank vaults."
"What else do you have on him?" asked Kennedy.
"Not a lot, but this isn't the guy I would worry about. My bet is Aziz recruited this 18-year-old fellow from Gaza as cannon fodder."
Kennedy looked down at Flood's desk and thought about the possibilities.
"Can you locate him?"
"I already have my people checking on all three. So far, I've only been able to confirm the whereabouts of the Jordanian officer."
"I thought you kept close tabs on these dissidents."
"We do," started Fine, "but things are a little stressed over here right now. What is the phrase you like to use? The natives are restless. We have another intifada on our hands. Aziz seems to have motivated every Palestinian between the age of 2 and 70 to pick up a rock and protest."
Kennedy had been so focused on the immediate concerns of the crisis that she hadn't thought of the repercussions it might be having abroad. What Fine said made sense, and if they didn't step in and handle things more firmly, it would only get worse.
"Ben, it would be a big help if you could track down this kid as soon as possible."
"I have my best people on it, Irene. I can assure you of that."
"Thank you, Ben. Is there anything else?"
"Well..." There was a 4-second pause. "The word on the street is that you grabbed Sheikh Harut the night before last."
"Where are you hearing that?"
"Several sources, actually. The Huns are all guessing it was either you or me, and since I know it wasn't me, then it must be you."
"I'm not in a position to discuss that matter right now, but I can assure you when I know anything about it, you will be briefed fully."
Fine didn't say anything for a long while and then said,
"Irene, this is uncomfortable for me, but there are those in my government who are very unhappy with the way this crisis is being handled."
Kennedy turned around and sat on the edge of General Flood's desk. There were many that put in her shoes
would simply have told the colonel that the U.S. was doing just fine managing the crisis and that it would be appreciative if its allies would keep their opinions to themselves. Fine continued,
"It is our fear that you may make a short-term decision that could be catastrophic to Israel's interests."
Kennedy thought about Fine's words honestly and refused to let nationalism seep into her thought process. There was no doubt that Israel had a lot on the line, and it didn't take a Rhodes Scholar to figure out how they would like the crisis resolved. Kennedy usually stayed out of this type of discussion, but in the current situation, and considering her own frustration with Vice President Baxter, she felt it prudent to try to assuage some of Fine's fears. She also knew that whatever she said would be relayed up to the highest levels of the Israeli government.
"Ben, people like us don't make policy. We only advise. Having said that, however, I can assure you that at every juncture of this crisis, there have been those of us who have forcefully stated our concerns over our relationship with your country. Our concern that we don't lose focus on our long-term commitment to Israel's security and stability in the Middle East."
Fine again digested the comments in silence and then added tensely,
"There are those in my government who are very nervous."
Pausing again, Kennedy could hear the stress in his breathing.
"There are many who don't like the fact that you are dealing with Aziz, that you have done an about-face on your position of not negotiating with terrorists."
Kennedy chose her words carefully.
"There are many in my own government who do not like this change in policy, but this is an extremely difficult situation."
"Who has made these decisions to negotiate?"
"Ben, you are moving into an area that I am not comfortable discussing."
"Well, then, let me say this last thing. We have a good idea where this is headed, and we will do whatever it takes to protect our security."
Fine stopped and then repeated himself,
"Whatever it takes."
"I understand," replied Kennedy.
The colonel couldn't have been clearer, and Kennedy knew that he had been told what to say by someone above his pay grade. Quite possibly the Prime Minister himself.
"Is this something that I should pass on as an official or unofficial position of your country?"
"It has always been our position that we will do whatever it takes to protect ourselves."
"Then why the need to remind me?"
"Because," started Fine, "this is an unusual situation, and we would not want anyone to question where Israel stands on this issue."
"Fair enough, Ben. I will make sure that your position is well known."
Running a hand through her hair, she added,
"I need to check on some things. Could you do me a favor and let me know just as soon as you track down your 18-year-old dissident?"
"Of course. When can I expect to hear more about Sheikh Harut?"
Kennedy knew she had to give him something, or at least the promise of something.
"You can expect me to brief you fully when I have a chance to take a breath."
Kennedy intentionally let loose a tired sigh.
"I understand. Please keep me informed, and I will do the same."
"Thank you, Ben."
Kennedy kept the phone in her hand and disconnected the call by pressing the button in the cradle. Quickly, she punched in 7 numbers, and when the person on the other end answered, she asked to be connected to a certain location via code word. Approximately 20 seconds after that, Dr. Hornig was on the phone.
"Jane," started Kennedy, "I need you to ask Harut what he knows about one of the terrorists named Mustafa Yassin. Specifically, ask him if Yassin is a teenage Palestinian or an Iraqi." "May I ask what this is all about?"
"I can't really get into it right now. I just need some verification."
"All right. I'll see what I can do."
The door to General Flood's office opened, and the general himself entered with General Campbell and Director Stansfield. Kennedy turned away from them and said,
"I have to go. How long do you think it will take to get the info?"
"I don't know. We seem to be losing him a bit."
"How do you mean?" asked Kennedy, as her face twisted into an expression of concern.
"The techniques we use are not exactly beneficial to the long-term health of the human brain."
"You mean You're losing him as in he's turning into a vegetable?
Crudely put, yes. But we have extracted an extraordinary amount of information. I have found out some very interesting things that will give us terrific insight into the minds of...
That's fine, Jane, Kennedy cut Hornig off. But I really need you to ask him those questions about Yassine. And the sooner I get the answers, the better. I have to go now. Call me as soon as you get anything.
With that, Kennedy hung up the phone just as General Flood made his way around the backside of the desk. Flood looked at Kennedy and asked, "What's wrong now?"
Kennedy exhaled. "We might have a problem."
"What kind of problem?" asked Flood.
Looking across the room, Kennedy placed her hands on her hips and said, "I'm not sure, but I hope to know more within the hour." Then, looking to her boss, she said, "Colonel Fine passed on a little message for us." Stansfield nodded knowingly and said,
"I was beginning to wonder when they would weigh in."
Kennedy walked over to where Stansfield and Campbell were standing. "He said that they will do whatever it takes to protect themselves."
Approaching the group several steps behind Kennedy, Flood pronounced, "Good for them. At least someone is sticking by their guns in this mess."
"What happened after I left?"
The group settled into their seats, and General Flood began to recount for Kennedy the strategy laid forth by Vice President Baxter. Judging from the facial expressions around the room, even Thomas Stansfield's, it was clear what was thought of the Vice President's plans. It seemed as if things were only going to get worse. Chapter 32. The door was so hot in one spot that Warch could only touch it for a second or two at a time. He took this as a terrible sign. That, and the fact that nightfall had come and gone and there had been no abatement in the drilling. Things were getting bleaker by the moment, and you could see it on the faces of the tired agents. To make matters worse for the Secret Service agents, President Hayes had done the unthinkable. He had ordered all of them to place their weapons on the small table near the kitchenette. The president made it clear that there were to be no acts of bravado, that they would surrender without a shot. In Hayes's opinion, if the terrorists got the door open, there would be no sense in further bloodshed. At that point, the battle would be over. Warch had tried only once to change President Hayes's mind, but it was to no avail. Hayes was steadfast in his decision that there would be no more bloodshed. As Warch stood by the vault door, Hayes came over. The president placed his hand on the door.
"It's getting warmer."
"Yep," answered Warch.
"Any bright ideas?"
"Nope."
Hayes gestured for Warch to follow him. They walked over to the couches and sat, Warch on the love seat and Hayes on the couch. Hayes looked at Warch and said,
"Jack, stop beating yourself up. There's nothing else we can do."
"It's not in my personality to give up, sir."
"Well, that's admirable, but I just want you to know that I appreciate everything you and your men have done."
"Thank you."
A question had been burning in Warch's mind since the attack. With the president in such a complimentary mood, Warch decided to ask it.
"Sir, who was that prince, and how did he get in to see you?"
Hayes had thought long and hard about this over the last 2 days, and he kept going back to his meeting in the Situation Room 3 nights ago. The meeting where he had authorized the abduction of Farah Harout. In that meeting, he had seen a black-and-white photograph of Rafiq Aziz. It was an old one, but the eyes had left an impression on him. The face was different, but there was something about the eyes that made him think it was Aziz.
"I can't be sure, but I think it might have been Rafiq Aziz. Or if it wasn't, it was one of his people."
Warch nodded.
"I told you about the call I got from Irene Kennedy right before the attack."
Hayes nodded.
"Well, I've never seen a photo of Aziz, but whoever that man was standing in the Oval Office, I didn't like the look in his eye."
"I've seen a photo of him, but it was old."
"Sir, I'll understand if you don't want to answer this question."
Warch looked at the president to see if he was open. Hayes nodded for Warch to go ahead.
"I have my suspicions, but I'd like to know for sure.
What did these terrorists hang in front of the DNC to entice them into getting a face-to-face meeting with you? Hayes thought for a moment. It was ingrained in his political instincts to avoid answering this question. He had worked on the Hill for 20-plus years, and the only thing that was as certain as hot summers in Washington was congressional investigations. And when this whole thing was over, they would see an endless stream of investigations, reviews, and reports. If recent history had taught Hayes anything, it was that the cover-up usually created more problems than it solved. If national security wasn't on the line, it was best to get everything out in the open. For this mess, that would damage the party. How much was anyone's guess, but it was better than dragging the whole thing out for years. The politics of greed had shown its ugly head in the worst of ways, and because of it, they were now in this fix. Hayes knew what was the right thing to do, and it was probably better to do it now, while he felt a sense of honor, because God only knew if he waited until he was out of this, he'd have a room full of lawyers and consultants telling him to keep his mouth shut and say nothing. Feeling indebted and unusually forthright, Hayes began to tell Warch what had happened. Aziz grinned from ear to ear as he watched the pundits, experts, and analysts go over every word of his speech to the American people. He had changed back into his fatigues and was sitting in the Situation Room. He now sat, remote control in hand, simultaneously watching 6 TVs with his feet up on the long conference table. He was spending more and more of his time with MSNBC on the main screen, but whenever he saw someone on one of the other stations with a title such as former FBI agent or counterterrorism expert, he couldn't resist switching to that station. The analysis was almost exactly as he thought it would be. For every law enforcement type, there was a former State Department official, politician, journalist, or religious leader that would talk of a peaceful solution to a horrible situation. His favorite comment so far had come from some Baptist minister who had noted an incredible amount of religious tolerance on the part of Mr. Aziz in his acknowledgement of our Christian God. They were literally falling all over themselves in an attempt to make it sound as if a nonviolent end to the crisis was within sight. They were saying things like, the ball is now in Vice President Baxter's court. If he wants to find a way out of this horrible siege, this will probably be his best chance. Aziz loved it. The pressure was a reality. It was no longer something he hoped he could elicit. If things went as planned, he would be in a perfect position for his final demand and his triumphant return to the Middle East. The U.S. would meet his most recent demand. Most of its allies would just as soon begin trading with Iraq again. As long as military hardware and technology were off the table, the deal was palatable to all but Britain and Israel. Aziz confidently rubbed his chin as he thought of the moment when the vault door would be opened, the moment he looked into the eyes of a defeated president of the United States. The sheer joy of being able to gloat over President Hayes, hold a gun to his head, and watch him cry. After he had broken Hayes and made him think his life was about to end, he would show him the slightest ray of hope, and slowly, he would reveal to him how there was a peaceful way to resolve the entire crisis. Then he would change back into his suit and shock the world by going on national TV with President Hayes. The endless parade of military personnel and Secret Service agents who had sworn on their reputations that the president was safe in his bunker would be embarrassed and shamed. They would be shunned in favor of the politicians who could broker the safe release of the president and the hostages. Aziz was relishing his exceedingly favorable luck when an image on one of the TVs caught his attention. His feet were off the table in a second, and the remote control was pointed toward the main TV like a gun. As the channel changed, the unmistakable image of Sheikh Farah Harout took center stage. Aziz's eyes widened as he listened to the anchor on NBC talk about reports out of the UN that Iran was protesting the abduction of an Islamic cleric. A moment later, a woman appeared on the TV. Aziz listened to the anchor say,
We're fortunate to have with us Sheila Dunn from the Washington Post. Sheila, you wrote an article that appeared on the front page of the Post this morning. Can you explain how that article might tie in with this most recent development between Iran and the UN?
Yes. Dunn looked seriously into the camera. I have it from the highest sources that the CIA alerted the Secret Service that the White House was targeted for a terrorist attack. It appears that this warning was given with just minutes to spare.
The anchor leaned forward, placing his elbow on the desk. How do Sheikh Harut and Iran figure in this?
Well, Iran has filed a grievance with the UN stating that a group of commandos from a foreign country carried out a mission in the Iranian town of Bandar Abbas 3 nights ago that left dozens dead and Sheikh Farah Harut missing. Sheikh Harut is the spiritual leader of the group Hezbollah, and he and Rafiq Aziz are very close. So it stands to reason that the CIA obtained the advance information of the attack from Sheikh Harut.
Do we know what role, if any, the CIA played in this raid?
No. Dunn shook her head, acting as if she was really disappointed. Both the Pentagon and Central Intelligence Agency have refused comment on the subject.
Aziz turned the television off. He would make them pay. The connection had been made, and there was no way they could lie their way out of it. Someone would die for this. Abruptly, Aziz turned and started for the door.
A specially outfitted U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter ferried Kennedy, Stansfield, General Flood, and General Campbell from the Pentagon to Langley. When they arrived in the control room on the 7th floor, they all stood in silence while they looked up at the wall of monitors. One of the watch officers had called Kennedy and warned her what was happening. In truth, it didn't surprise her. If she hadn't had so many other things on her mind, she probably would have predicted it. Thomas Stansfield stood, impassive, looking at the large wall, taking in the tiny images. General Flood and General Campbell were a different matter, however. They were men who were used to giving an order and having it followed to the letter, and almost always without question. In this particular situation, General Campbell couldn't have been more specific. He had told Rapp in very clear English that he was to stay put until further notice. In addition to the monitor that showed the inside of the president's bedroom and the one that showed Lieutenant Commander Harris's makeshift command post, 4 more monitors now showed images. They said it all. Those screens didn't come to life all on their own, and since Mitch Rapp was the only person capable of installing them, it was obvious that he had directly disobeyed General Campbell. Kennedy looked at one of the watch officers sitting in the back row.
Have you tried to raise him?
Repeatedly.
Any luck?
Kennedy knew the answer before the man started to shake his head.
Director Stansfield walked toward the front of the room so he could more closely examine the monitors. He tried looking at the monitors both with and without his bifocals. 2 of them covered staircases. The old director knew from memory which ones they were. The other 2 monitors covered the wide main hallways that cut east-west across the 2nd and 3rd floors. As Stansfield was watching, a 5th monitor came online. This one showed a staircase that he was not familiar with. The row of technicians and analysts to his left began talking in earnest as several of them hurriedly flipped through books about the White House. After several seconds, one of them pronounced that the staircase in question was the one that led from the 3rd floor to the roof. Stansfield looked from the monitor back to the rear of the room to find General Flood and General Campbell engaged in a heated and animated discussion. Watching the 2 generals talk, Stansfield's face maintained its always neutral expression. His discerning mind was, however, busy extrapolating the problems, complaints, and solutions that this most current bump in the road would create. In a matter of seconds, Stansfield had the solutions formed, filed, and ready to be stated in his always unambiguous fashion. Slowly, he started back up the stairs. When he reached the 2 generals, he placed a hand on General Flood's shoulder and said,
"Let's go to my office where we can talk."
Stansfield started for the door and gave Kennedy a look that told her to join them. The group proceeded through a locked and guarded door, down a ramp, and then onward to the director's corner office. As soon as Stansfield heard his soundproof office door close, he knew what was about to happen, and it did.
"This is absolutely unacceptable," stated a barely restrained General Campbell. "I gave him a direct order. I don't care how good his reasons may or may not be. This is bigger than him, and we cannot have him running around doing whatever he wants when he wants."
Stansfield turned around to face Campbell. Kennedy, the last one to enter the room, stopped midway between her boss and the generals. Stansfield nodded slowly, acknowledging Campbell's complaint. With his jaw clenched, Campbell continued,
"I ordered him to stand down because I knew we would be out of the loop for at least an hour. What happens if he gets caught? If he kills one of Aziz's men, we need to be here." Campbell pointed at the ground. "We need to be monitoring every little move, so if the shit hits the fan, we can give the order to move."
Campbell was so upset, it seemed that his bristly flat top was standing even more upright than usual.
"Your boy needs to start following orders, or I swear to God."
The stocky ranger stammered for a second, his neck veins bulging. Campbell didn't finish the thought, but it was obvious to all that he was thinking of physical confrontation. Stansfield nodded slowly in an effort to validate Campbell's anger. Somewhere in the back of his mind, he wondered who would actually win that fight. Campbell, although 20 years rap senior, was not a man to be trifled with. Shifting his gaze from Campbell to Flood, Stansfield asked,
"Would you like to add anything?"
Flood shook his sizable head.
"There's nothing left to say. It's a no-brainer. Rap is wrong and he needs to be reeled in."
Stansfield digested Flood's comments. They were every bit as warranted as Campbell's. The director of Central Intelligence walked around his desk and looked out the window for a brief moment. The day was as it had been for the last two, sunny and bright. Turning back to the generals, Stansfield said,
"We have a difference of opinion, gentlemen. I'll tell you what I see. I see a man who is trained to act on his own. A man who is used to spending days, if not weeks, in the field without the aid or interference of his country. Mitch Rapp is not a soldier, and he most definitely is not a politician. His ability to know when to take risks, when to push ahead, when to pull back, is uncanny. It's quite honestly the best I've ever seen. He thrives in this environment where every decision could mean life or death."
Stansfield paused for a moment, and then in an almost academic tone continued,
"He has a much clearer picture of the tactical situation, not only because he is on site, but because he is not distracted by all of the things that we are."
For clarity, he added,
"Most notably, he doesn't have to deal with Vice President Baxter."
Clutching his hands in front of him, and then letting them fall to his side, Stansfield continued,
"Now, with all due respect, gentlemen, you know I think very highly of both of you, but you must understand, Mitch is not a soldier. He has been trained from day one to think independently. If you want to get mad about this, which you have every right to, then get mad at me. He is my responsibility."
Stansfield stopped just long enough to make it seem as though he was giving them a chance to reply, and then said,
"We've made a mistake with you two."
He pointed to Campbell and Kennedy.
"I don't want you attending any more meetings. I want you right here monitoring Rapp and his progress. There are too many meddlesome issues that General Flood and I can handle. I want you two focused on Mitch and how best to aid him. He is our eyes."
The elderly spymaster looked from Campbell to Kennedy and back.
"The way I see it, he's doing exactly what we sent him in there to do. Now, General Campbell, if you want to go in there and get Mitch on the radio and read him the riot act, that's fine. That is undoubtedly your prerogative, and I'm not going to stand in your way. But it won't do us a bit of good because he won't listen."
Stansfield could see that his words were getting to Campbell. The ranger's demeanor had calmed ever so slightly.
"What I would propose is that I have a talk with him and explain how important it is that he communicate his every action so we can deal with something if it comes up.
before Stansfield could start his next sentence, the large phone on his desk started to ring. Stansfield looked down to see where the call was coming from. On the small screen were a string of letters that caused his brow to knot into a frown. The light on the secure phone continued to blink, and Stansfield debated whether he should answer it. After two more rings, his frail hand moved slowly toward the receiver. The ambulance fought its way through the late morning traffic. Downtown D.C. was a quagmire. The security perimeter around the White House had been expanded from 2 to 3 blocks to the north, east, and west. To the south, Constitution Avenue had been blocked off, and the section of the National Mall between 17th and 14th was also closed. The normally congested downtown was unbearable. The driver of the ambulance inched forward on Pennsylvania Avenue. In his side mirror, he could see the large dome of the Capitol, and in front of him, a sea of cars locked in gridlock, trying to make their way into the heart of the business district and around the White House. Salim Roussan was surprisingly calm. Part of this was due to his faith in Aziz's plan, and part of it was due to the fact that he would much rather be stuck in traffic than stuck in the White House. The ambulance was the last car to make it through the stoplight at 9th Street. The monolithic Hoover Building appeared on his right, the famed FBI headquarters. Roussan did not smile. It was not in his personality. He was more like Benghazi than Aziz. He was a worrier, and that was why Aziz had chosen him for this crucial mission. Roussan was both the backup plan and the surprise. Depending on how things went, he was to do one of three things. The first was easy and harmless, and despite what Aziz had told the men, Roussan seriously doubted that option would ever present itself. It would be either the second or the third plan that would have to be executed, and both of those would lead to death. Roussan was sure of it. Not just the death of his comrades, but the hostages, the American FBI agents, and hopefully hundreds of others. Roussan's only hope was that in the chaos that would erupt when the Americans tried to retake their White House, he could further add to the confusion and buy some of his friends the time to get away. Roussan thought he had a chance to survive. The plan for his escape was good, well thought out, and just might work. It was unnerving nonetheless to be heading back into the center of the crisis, to the spot where just 3 days earlier he had fired from the roof of the Washington Hotel and killed a half dozen Americans. The boldness of the plan was what gave success a chance. Practically every law enforcement officer in the world was looking for him. The old him, he corrected himself. They would never make the connection between Salim Roussan, the dark-haired Islamic militant terrorist, and Steve Hernandez, the openly gay paramedic from Miami. No, he would continue to inch his way toward the White House, taking his time. When he reached the first roadblock, he would hit the lights on the roof, roll down the window, and tell the D.C. police that he had been told to come down in case they needed him. Aziz had told him it was standard procedure for this type of crisis. He would be one of dozens of ambulances waiting to rush people to the hospital if the need arose. Roussan had time. The American assassins did not show their faces when the sun was out. They would wait until it was dark. And if Aziz's timetable was right, they would come either tonight or tomorrow. As long as he had everything in position within an hour or two after the sunset, he would be fine. Chapter 33. Deep in thought, Anna Reilly sat, feet pulled close, arms wrapped around her shins, and her chin resting in the valley between her knees. Her shoulder-length brown hair was pulled back in its ponytail again. The long sleeves of President Hayes's black sweatshirt were rolled up several times. She was comfortable, warm, and had a little bit of food in her stomach, along with 2 Tylenol 3s, which helped dull her aching jaw and ribs. All things considered, she was doing pretty darn well. How strange life could be, she thought to herself. 1 week ago, she was in Chicago, working at the station, living in her apartment in Lincoln Park. She was ready for a change in both her career and her personal life.
Since the rape, things had been jumbled. There had been the boyfriend who couldn't handle what she had been through. He was a pharmaceutical rep, and when offered a promotion and transfer to Phoenix, he jumped at the chance and told Anna he couldn't love someone who couldn't love him back. She'd blamed herself for that one until she was healthy enough to realize that if he had really loved her, he would have given her more than 7 months to recover. It had actually turned out to be a blessing. Spending the last several years alone had allowed her to grow in strength. Independence and self-reliance were great things. The best part about them was that the only person who could let you down was yourself. The downside, which she was now experiencing, was that you woke up one day and realized you had either pushed everybody away or not allowed anyone to get close enough. Either way, you were left with a lonely existence. Really thought fate had to figure into the equation somewhere. It always did for those large and defining moments in life. What kind of twisted fate had led her to this strange moment, this crossroad? If she hadn't gotten the job as the new White House correspondent, if she had missed her flight to D.C., if her alarm had failed to wake her up 3 days ago, if she had been released with that first group of hostages, if that pig hadn't dragged her up to the president's bedroom, Reilly's eyes got big. If Mitch Cruz, or whatever his real name was, hadn't stepped in when he did? Wow. Reilly thought as a shiver ran up her spine. The thought of Cruz not showing up when he did was horrifying. She owed him a lot, more than she could probably ever express. Reilly stared blankly at the wall opposite her. Her thoughts settled in on the man named Cruz, and on the odds of him appearing exactly where he did, and all of the possible outcomes in between. It was staggering. Call it fate, call it a guardian angel, call it what you like, but someone or something had stepped in and put him there at that exact moment in time. A smile fell across Reilly's face, and she looked upward to say a little prayer of thanks. Before picking up the phone, Stansfield told Kennedy to listen in on a second phone located on the other side of the room. He then asked Generals Flood and Campbell to stay silent. Stansfield's hand reached down and picked up the handset. At the same time, he sank into his chair and brought the phone to his ear.
"This is Director Stansfield."
At first, there was only breathing, heavy breathing, and then the words hissed forth.
"I know all about you, who you are, what you've done, and all of the people you've sent your missions to kill."
Stansfield looked down again at the readout on his phone. The black letters said W.H. Sit Room. The hostile voice he recognized as that of Rafik Aziz, and it didn't even come close to riling the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Instead, Stansfield leaned back and asked,
"What can I do for you, Mr. Aziz?"
"Do for me?" spat an obviously agitated Aziz. "You can tell me what you have done with Farah Harout."
It was a statement made with confidence. Stansfield was sure of that. The director stayed cool and replied,
"I have no idea what you are talking about."
"Don't insult me," screamed Aziz. "I know what you have done, and I want to know where Farah Harout is immediately, or you are going to have more dead hostages on your hands."
Aziz was screaming so loud that Flood and Campbell could hear him from where they were standing. The two men stepped forward while Stansfield replied,
"It is not my intention to insult you. I sincerely have no idea what you're talking about."
"You are a snake," screamed Aziz. "I should have known better than to have thought for a second that you would give me the truth. I swear I will make you pay for what you have done."
Aziz was now yelling so loud, Stansfield pulled the phone away from his ear and listened to Aziz ramble from a more comfortable distance of 6 inches. The voice squawked from the earpiece.
"You give me the truth right now, or I will walk down the hall and put a bullet in the head of one of the hostages, and when I come back, if you do not have an answer for me, I will go back and kill another. And I will keep doing it until you tell me what you have done with Farah Harout."
"Mr. Aziz," replied an unflinching Stansfield, "I have no idea what you are talking about. If you would tell me what has got you so angry, I will do my best to find out where Farah Harut is.
Don't toy with me. I know who you are and what you do. You are a liar and a murderer of innocent women and children.
Stansfield sat calmly in the chair, the phone still held several inches away from his ear. He had to think quickly, and he had to get Aziz to back down.
Well, Mr. Aziz, if that's the way you feel about me, we must have a lot in common.
Without giving Aziz a chance to reply to the shot, Stansfield continued.
By the way, I must commend you for your speech this morning. It really played well with the politicians. I tried to advise them that you were not serious, that you were performing. To and for what, I have not yet figured out, but I have my ideas.
Silence! Screamed Aziz. I want to know where Farah Harut is immediately, or someone dies!
Mr. Aziz, you don't want to do that, and this is why.
Stansfield glanced up at the two generals for a second, and then said,
Right now you've done a very good job making certain people in my government think that you have turned over a new leaf, and that you are a man who will actually keep his word. Myself and several others know this is all a sham. If you kill another hostage, I will take a tape of this conversation to the Vice President, and I will leak it to the media so everyone can hear that you are truly not the man you tried to portray yourself as this morning. And then, well, you know our rules of engagement. You were lucky we didn't storm the place after you killed National Security Advisor Schwartz and his secretary. If you start killing hostages again, we will be left no alternative other than to retake the building. And that, of course, means you will die.
Your men will die, screamed Aziz. You are a bigger fool than I thought. I will blow this whole building sky high and all of the hostages with it.
And you will die also, which just happens to suit my needs perfectly. Things will be much easier if you cease to exist.
Stansfield leaned back in his chair.
You are threatening the wrong man, Mr. Aziz, and you know it.
Now came the time to lie, to really make Aziz think that he was everything Aziz thought he was, and then some.
I could not care less what happens to the hostages. I just want to make sure that you and your wretched comrades are dead when this whole thing is over. If we have to lose 40 or 50 hostages to mount your head on the wall, it's a small price to pay.
I am not afraid to die. Even if I die, I will have won.
I don't think so, replied Stansfield in his calm, analytical voice. You see, after you have killed yourself, we will pluck President Hayes and quite a few others out of the rubble, and you will have ceased to be a problem. We will rebuild the White House in 6 months, and everything will return to normal.
Aziz was enraged, but he knew that Stansfield had him boxed in, for now at least. But oh, the surprise they would be in for when their president wasn't so safe. Now was not the time to push things, no matter how much Farah Harut meant. Aziz could not do anything to precipitate an attack by the Americans until he had the president in his hands. Aziz would have to swallow his pride and make a tactical retreat. His ego, however, was far too large to do so without taking a parting shot.
You are too sure of yourself, Mr. Stansfield, Aziz spoke in a low, ominous tone. Things are not always as they appear. We will talk again this evening, and by then you had better know where Farah Harut is.
With that, the line went dead. Stansfield set the phone back in its cradle and looked up at the two generals. General Flood asked,
What in the hell was that all about?
Stansfield glanced up at Kennedy as she walked across the large office.
He knows Harut is gone and thinks we have him.
I got that part of it. What was the rest of it about?
He said if I didn't tell him right away where Harut was, he would kill a hostage.
And that's when you decided to play chicken with him? Asked Campbell.
Stansfield shrugged his shoulders. It was hardly the phrase he would have used to describe his method.
I took a risk. I obviously don't want to see any of those hostages killed. All I did was give him the answer that fits his belief of who I really am.
Stansfield rubbed his forefinger under his chin.
And he blinked.
Kennedy placed both hands on her hips and frowned. There was more to it than that, Thomas. He didn't just blink. He rolled over and showed you his belly, and did it way too fast. It was out of character.
Maybe he's getting tired?
Kennedy shook her head. No, there's something else going on. Something I haven't told you about yet because I wanted to check on a few things before I got everybody worried. Kennedy moved her hands from her hips and folded them across her chest. I picked up something in Aziz's voice. When you, Kennedy pointed to Stansfield, told him that he would be doing us a favor by killing himself because when it was all over we would pull President Hayes from his bunker and so forth. Kennedy made a rotating motion with her finger. When you were finished, the first thing he said in response was, "You are too sure of yourself, Mr. Stansfield. Things are not always as they appear." Did you notice the tone in his voice? Kennedy looked at her boss hard and gave him a second to recall what Aziz's words had sounded like. She continued, "He sounded like he knew something that we didn't." Stansfield looked at her as if she was reading a little too far into things, and she responded, "Let me fill you in on some other information first, and then it might make more sense." Stepping toward her boss, Kennedy looked up at the generals and said, "That phone call I received from Colonel Fine this morning was in regard to three names he was checking for me. Three names we got from Harut. One of the names had three matches. The first was an officer in the Jordanian army, and he's already been ruled out. The second, and we thought the most likely, was an 18-year-old Palestinian kid with suspected ties to Hamas, and the third was a man known as the Thief of Baghdad. It turns out the third of the three Mustafa Yassins is the Iraqi who was in charge of looting all of the banks and vaults after they invaded Kuwait."
General Flood shook his head. "It's obviously the second one, Irene."
"It could be," conceded Kennedy with a nod. "But what if it's the third one? What if Aziz brought along this Thief of Baghdad, knowing there was a good chance the president would get to his bunker? What if at this very moment this man is working on getting the president out of his bunker?" Kennedy stopped and looked each man in the eye, one at a time, while she gave them a chance to think about it. "What if Aziz said to Thomas, 'You are too sure of yourself, things are not always as they appear,' because he knows President Hayes is not as safe as we thought?" Everyone's eyes got a little bigger as Kennedy finished stating her case. General Flood looked down at Stansfield and said,
"I think this is something we need to bring to the attention of the Vice President."
Stansfield stared back at him blankly for a while and then said,
"Not quite yet. We need a little more proof before we go to him."
"Well, how do we get that proof?"
"I have a pretty good idea,"
Stansfield replied with a nod. Chapter 34. Rapp backed down the long cross hall of the second floor. Each step was placed carefully, heel first and then toe. The cross hall, which was more a long room than a hallway, was brightly bathed in the late morning sunlight. Rapp and Adams, dressed in their black Nomex jumpsuits, stood out against the light-colored walls and carpet. They felt secure, though. Having been out of the stash room for over an hour, they had placed all five of the surveillance units and checked each one to make sure it was working. At no time during their sweep did they see or hear a sign of the terrorists. Even when they checked out the back staircase that led to the rooftop guard booth, there had been nothing. With the units in place, Rapp felt infinitely more comfortable now that he had a secure base from which to operate. How they felt back at Langley would be a different matter entirely. Rapp had known this before he stepped out of the stash room with Adams some 70 minutes ago, but that was just tough shit. There were too many people sticking their fingers in the pie. This thing needed to be streamlined, and someone needed to take action. Sitting around and playing cautious was not in Rapp's nature, especially where Aziz was concerned. Rapp knew whom he was dealing with. He knew what Aziz was up to, and if nobody else could figure it out, to hell with them. This was not one of those moments in life where disagreement was acceptable. This wasn't a policy decision where it was difficult to quantify the benefits of one course over the other. This was black and white. Rapp knew what had to be done, and everyone else could kiss his ass if they weren't on board. As they made it back to the president's bedroom, Adams entered first, and then Rapp. Rapp stood in the doorway for a moment and took one last look to his left, straight ahead, and to his right. Behind him, on the other side of the bedroom, a stench was beginning to drift from the body of the dead terrorist. Rapp noticed it and cringed at the thought of how bad the smell would get in another day. Adams tapped him on the shoulder and said,
"I've got to piss like a racehorse."
Rapp stepped back into the room and nodded to the bathroom. Adams went in and closed the door behind him. A couple minutes later, he reappeared, a look of relief on his face.
"You just wait," Adams looked at Rapp. "You're too young to understand, but someday you'll know what it's like."
"Yeah, if only I live that long." Adam took the thick barrel of a silencer and pointed to the closet. "Let's check on Anna." Adams went in first and pressed the hidden button. As the closet organizer swung out, Adams stepped into the stash room. Rapp poked his head in and said to Reilly, "Do you need to use the restroom?" Reilly nodded enthusiastically. "Follow me, and don't make any noise." Then, looking to Adams, Rapp said, "Monitor the stairwells until we're back, and let me know if you have any movement." Reilly stood and followed Rapp quietly, which was easy to do in her stocking feet. Walking into the bathroom, Reilly closed the door behind her, and for the first time saw herself in the mirror. She had one hell of a shiner on her cheek, and her skin looked a little pasty. Without wasting too much time in front of the mirror, she got down to business and took care of her more immediate needs. In the middle of that task, she was struck by the bizarre thought that she was sitting on President Hayes's toilet. The same toilet that quite a few presidents had used. When she was done, she closed the lid. Hanging on a bar next to the sink were two sets of washcloths and hand towels. Reilly couldn't resist. She felt disgusting and dirty. Opening the faucets, she doused her face with water and began to rub a bar of soap vigorously in her hands. After cleaning and drying her face quickly, she had another idea. Reilly soaped up one of the washcloths and wetted another and one of the hand towels. Next, she checked the medicine cabinet and grabbed the president's shaving kit. Wrapping everything up in a larger bath towel, Reilly opened the door and found Rapp waiting for her. Rapp looked at the towels and asked, "What's that all about?" Clutching the bundle in her arms, she looked up and said, "A little sponge bath." Rapp pointed to himself with a big smile on his face and said, "For me." Reilly almost laughed, but instead shook her head. "No, for me." Rapp kept the smile on his face as the two of them went back into the stash room. Once inside, the door was again closed and bolted. Rapp looked at the radio and knew that he had some explaining to do. Deciding it was better to get on with it, he knelt down and powered up the unit. Milt Adams had the monitor opened on his chest and was checking the reception on each surveillance unit again. When the unit was ready, Rapp picked up the handset and said, "Iron Man to control, do you read? Over." It didn't surprise Rapp that a voice came back right away. He had expected that. It was the particular voice that surprised him.
"Iron Man, you've been a little busy since we last spoke."
Rapp hesitated for a moment. "Yes, sir. I thought it was the right thing to do."
"I concur," said Thomas Stansfield. "But from now on, let us know what you're up to. We are receiving clearly on both the visual and the audio. They should be a big help. Now, I've got something rather immediate that I need you to check on. We have reason to believe that the president might not be as safe as we thought."
Rapp's eyes darted from the console of the field radio to Milt Adams. "Please clarify."
"Aziz may have brought someone along who specializes in breaking into vaults."
There was a pause.
"Is that clear enough?"
"I think so. How quickly would you like me to verify this?"
"As quickly as you can without risking exposure."
Rapp sat on his heels. He thought about the location of the bunker, the third basement.
The only way in or out was one staircase, the same one where an unexpected guard had been posted last night.
Sir, let me discuss this with Milt and see what type of a plan we can put together. I'll get back to you in 5 or less.
Rapp set the hard plastic handset down and looked to Adams.
Zip that thing up and get your blueprints out.
Adams could tell by both Rapp's expression and tone that something serious had just been discussed. After he finished zipping the monitor up, Adams pulled out his sheaf of blueprints. Rapp scooted forward on his knees.
Excuse me, Anna.
Reilly was sitting in the corner with her legs stretched out in front of her. As Rapp moved around her, he looked at the blueprints and said,
"Show me the entire third level and all the ways in or out."
Adams reached to the bottom of the stack and pulled out the last sheet. Then, grabbing it with both hands, he laid it down on top.
"This is it. There's only one stairwell in and out, the one that we used."
Looking up from the blueprint, Adams asked,
"Tell me what you're looking for, and I might be able to help a little more."
Reilly appeared on her knees at Rapp's side. She looked down at the blueprint and asked, "What's that?" Rapp felt a tinge of anxiety. Another nuisance to deal with. Why couldn't things be simple for once? Rapp cocked his head to the side and looked at Reilly, who was studying the blueprint in earnest. It was time to take this obstacle off the table. There were going to be too many variables coming down the home stretch, and he needed to keep the process as simple as possible. The more he had to think about, the better the odds were that he'd screw up. And screwing up on this one meant that someone would die, most probably himself. There was one thing that would free them up a bit. Rapp had thought about it earlier in the day and decided if Reilly would go along with the idea, it would make things easier from a logistical standpoint.
"Anna, we need to talk."
Reilly looked up at him from the blueprint. "What about?"
"I need to be able to speak freely with Milt, and I can't do that with you sitting here. So you have to promise me that you will do something when we get out of here."
"Sure."
"I am going to need you to sign a national security non-disclosure agreement."
Reilly moved back a bit. She was familiar with the document, and the thought of signing such a thing was ludicrous. She was a reporter, for Christ's sake. She would be bound by law never to discuss the matters outlined in the document, and that most probably meant never being able to tell her story. Her head slowly started to move from side to side.
"I don't think so.
I don't like the idea of the government holding something like that over my head. I'm a reporter. It wouldn't be right." Rapp got a little angry. It showed in the way his eyes squinted just a millimeter or two. At that moment, he looked at Reilly, and all he saw was a beautiful, selfish, self-centered woman. He didn't have the time or patience for this.
"Fine," he pronounced in a tone that was anything but. "I'll have to remember that our careers are number one priority. In fact, I probably should have kept that in mind last night."
Rapp turned away from Reilly and grabbed the radio handset. "Iron Man to control, over."
"What was that supposed to mean?" asked Reilly in a wounded voice.
Rapp put his hand up to quiet her and spoke into the handset.
"We are going to go investigate right now. This will only be a light recon. I repeat, a light recon. If we meet any resistance, we will abort and try to find another way to verify. Over."
Rapp nodded several times and said,
"Correct."
After placing the handset back in its cradle, Rapp looked at Adams and said,
"Come on, Milt. We'll finish the rest of this conversation in the elevator."
Rapp grabbed his submachine gun and rose to one knee. Reilly reached out for his arm.
"Hold on a minute. What's with the attitude all of the sudden?"
"The attitude." Rapp pulled away and stood. "Last night when that piece of shit dragged you up here to rape you, I turned this radio off because I knew that the people running this show would have told me to stay put, that the mission was bigger than just one person." Rapp stared her straight in the eye and pointed at himself. "What I did last night was not a real big career enhancer, but all I saw out there was a woman who needed help and some piece of shit that deserved to die. Cut and dry, plain and simple." Rapp turned to Adams. "Let's go." Reilly was shocked by the extreme change in his manner. She attempted to speak, but Rapp cut her off.
"Anna, I'm done talking."
With his submachine gun up and ready, he placed his free hand on the bolt and said,
If I come across any paper and pens, I'll grab them so you can start working on your tell-all story. With that parting shot, Rapp slid back the bolt and slipped into the walk-in closet. Chapter 35. They stepped into the small elevator without talking.